Welcome to VCR, Vintage Cinema Rewind, bringing old movies to new viewers. I'm Blake.
And I'm Jason. And Blake, how'd you get past that guard?
Well, to tell you the truth, I lied a little.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite quotes of Chinatown. It's a small scene, small moment, but just the delivery, again, from Jack Nicholson is just on point.
It's dripping Jack Nicholson.
Yes, it is. This is the thing, is I talked about this in the Primer episode. This is our deep dive episode where we go full spoilers ahead through Chinatown, discussing everything behind the camera, in front of the camera. So if you haven't seen Chinatown before, highly recommend going and checking out the Primer episode. But that's the one thing that I'll say about this and what I kind of said in the Primer episode is most of my experience of Jack Nicholson is in the latter half of his career. And he feels a lot more unhinged in the latter half of his career. Like, this is a really cool part in his filmography because he starts off very collected man and he's just like unwound throughout this entire movie.
Yeah. And it also is like personality in the beginning is so like he's a dick, but then he kind of reverts into like everything gets serious and you find out he's a good guy.
And that's like a almost like a trope, honestly, like with the detective is who's kind of an asshole who's built up this wall and doesn't let shit get to him.
But his he's like a frat boy asshole type.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, he's got his two coworkers that work for him, Lou, and I can't remember the other guy's name. And yeah, he's telling them dirty jokes and like asking his receptionist to leave so he can tell dirty jokes and stuff like that.
Which
like,
wouldn't stand up today.
No.
At least in the real world, it might fit into an old movie about the old days, but yeah.
But it's like very much like old boys club kind of style.
Yeah,
that's his character.
And he's like kind of balling out a little bit because he's like wearing a fancy suit and
pinstripe suit, like
and like his the lieutenant he used to work with in Chinatown is like, oh, where have you been? You look all fancy now.
It's a really cool like portrayal of his characters. Like, I actually really love seeing a film, like a mystery film, through the eyes of like a private investigator, because it feels like there's just something that you can connect more a little bit with this man who's kind of working slightly outside of the law. He's working like outside of conventional norms. There's something a little bit more exciting because, you know, he's not confined to what's legal and what's illegal necessarily.
Yeah, like he knows both the police system very well because he's used to be a police officer, and he knows what's happening outside of it, and he operates somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, and like there's this built-in disenfranchisement that he has with the system that like I really appreciate that. And that's kind of the whole, like, you know, the whole bigger story of what's going on, the whole bigger theme of this film, and that's something that I really appreciated watching this. But you know, like to speak about like one of the cool things that I really recognized about what his character did was when he was spying on Mulray in the earlier parts of the movie, and he uses the two pocket watches and puts them under the car tires so that he can time when the car leaves. That is such a great like MacGyvering of the system. And like, he's obviously done it before because he's got all those watches like sitting in his car, right? In his glove compartment. And it's such like a genius idea that when you're like, oh yeah, like this is the 30s. And that's part of the other thing is like, it's really great seeing movies at this time where like technology in the industrial age has like shot us like, you know, we're centuries ahead of like what most of humanity has lived in, but we're also like before all of this like really easy technological espionage, like pre-spy gadget, pre like James Bond era, right? You have to have such strong intuition, such strong problem skills, solving skills to get through this type of world.
Yeah, and that just showed exactly like he is good at his job. He knows what's going on and he's thinking outside the box.
Love his character and love his portrayal. Like you said, like when we start off in this film, like he's very put together. Like he looks like somebody who's really crushing it, like that people come to because they know him and they know his name and who he is.
Yeah.
You know, like when we see him getting immediately hired by who we think is Mrs. Mulray right off the bat, right? Like it just, the whole thing, that all playing out, like we have absolutely no reason to be suspicious of this at this point in time.
Yeah.
And that's what makes like that plot point so great, is that we're seeing this all through his eyes, and he's just portrayed as such a put together and intelligent man. Mm-hmm. To find out that like that wasn't even Mrs. Mulray is just like such a rug pull right immediately off the bat.
Yeah, it's also reflected in his appearance specifically with the nose cutting, which is right. So cool. Like this was such an awesome like unique thing. I've never seen. Like some actors these days will go through like drastic physical changes, but like this was just so like visceral, and it was crazy to see. Like Jack Nicholson just had this big ass ugly bandage on his nose. It looked so out of place. Like you would think in like a movie it would just be like a little stitch, but they made it look disgusting, and like he had to deal with it, and it was a plot point, and like people comment on it. Even just in that scene where they cut his nose, so he got like the rug pulled out from under him and they disfigured him.
Yeah, and like that's a great point as well. Like the something that The Nice Guys, a movie that, like I said, came out in the last 5 years that Jess and I just recently watched, really liked it, same sort of genre and everything. And they do that as well with Ryan Gosling's character and like breaking his arm and having him be in the cast the entire movie. But there's just something so much like more personable about fucking up a guy's nose and then like having him have to wear this big bandage, and then even when he takes it off, like he's got this, like all the stitches are showing there. It's really gross, it's really visceral, and it's just like, again, it's front and center of him and our perspective the entire movie. You know, it doesn't look nice. Like he doesn't, like he's like a Hollywood actor. He's somebody who wants to, like, you know, look good for the camera, and it's covering a large chunk of his face, and it's dead center of it.
And like there's a whole story behind like how they came up with it and like the knife they used and everything. And because Roman Polanski actually like did it, at a certain point they got so tired of the questions that they were like, I actually cut Jack Nicholson's nose.
Yeah.
And just like the way the man with knife, what he says before, he's like, "You're a very nosy kitty cat, huh? You know what happens to nosy fellows? Want to guess? No, they lose their noses." And then he just like,
and it looks so real too. Yeah, like that's the other thing, is like the way that they use this knife and like this prop knife, right? And it's almost like a real knife. Like they actually said that any sort of bad angle on this and it would have actually sliced his nose open.
Yeah,
it feels so real in that moment that that's happening. Yeah, it's just like that's one of those highlight moments in movie history.
Yeah, and all like it just drops the character into this whole other world that he hasn't been in before.
Yeah, that we haven't seen him in. Before this, the stakes feel like he almost feels untouchable. Like he almost has plot armor up until this moment, right? Like we expect our heroes to survive, and most of the time our heroes walk away with like minor wounds, or they'll be shot or and like
they'll
walk
outsmart,
away kind of thing.
They'll outsmart the like laser beam that's about to cut them in half because he's James Bond, like all that. Yeah, exactly. So this was like so metaphorical and so physical. The combination, how they did that was just awesome.
Yeah, for sure. You know, like how he gets connected into all of this as well is super interesting. Like I already talked about like the fake Mrs. Mulray.
Mm-hmm.
But like the fact that these people who are operating at such like this high level in this clouds that we can't even like, you know, begin to comprehend with us on the ground level kind of thing. The fact that they don't even recognize that what they've done to him in this situation in ruining Mulray is actually like also lit this fire under Jake, because, you know, like he feels personally like they've made him a fool, like, you know, like it's personally tarnished his name in a sense at this point in time. And so it becomes like a little bit of a personal endeavor for him to unravel this mystery.
Yeah, like by then it also feels like he's actually like trying to do the right thing for everyone. So like it's personal, and then it affects, like once it gets personal, it's like it affects him on a human level.
Yeah, and that's kind of part of like the prominence of Chinatown and the meaning behind Chinatown throughout this film, right? Because he alludes to it like several times, and like it's obvious by the end that this is something that was a very important, prominent time in his life. It's probably the reason why he ended up going to private investigative work, is because he could feel like he could actually help people for real in this area, line of work. His underlings bring it up to him at the very end of the movie. And so it's something that, like I said, it's something that people know about and his past, right? And so the whole like idea behind the Chinatown is that essentially, like, he explains this during his conversation with Cross. It's like, you know, when I was working in Chinatown with the lieutenant, there's just this whole underbelly of crime and despair going on. And for us to try to like solve any case or like arrest anybody, it's just like impossible to really know what's going on because of this whole deeper world. Like, we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg here.
Yeah. And in that conversation with Cross, it's summed up quite well when Cross says, "You may think you know what you're dealing with, but believe me, you don't." Jake like grins. Noah Cross is like, "Why is that funny?" And then Jake is like, "That's what the district attorney used to tell me in Chinatown." So
right.
It's like, it's all being brought back out. Like this whole, like in Chinatown, you can't, there's no justice to be found because you don't understand what's going on in Chinatown. There's all these, like, you don't speak the language.
There's people who are just like pulling all of the strings, and like, there's just like this deep underbelly of crime and corruption, and to try to like fix any of it, like, you don't know if you're making things better or worse. And so this is the other part of the quote, is that when he asks him, "What were you doing there?" he's like kind of jokingly says, "As little as possible," right? Because to really, like, other than trying somewhat to keep the peace in these situations, like, how do you dismantle crime that's so embedded in that region? And it's like the same as the bigger theme of this, right? Like, how do you dismantle crime that's at the top level? Like, the people who are, you know, pulling the strings, like the oligarchs who are running the show, right? Like, that's essentially who Cross is a stand-in for, is like oligarchs and oligarchy and just like that kind of system of. And that's, you know, in a sense, like a little bit how America and a lot of other countries are built around. And like, that's kind of like the other deep part of this, right? Is like, this is LA being built around these people at this point in time. And that speaks to actually the bigger truth of the 30s and even before, like the early 1900s to the 1930s of, you know, these people and the California water wars and everything. That's actually like a historical point in American history. It's something that, like, even by the end of the film, like, I honestly don't know that any other movie has really captured that idea so well. Like, and to kind of put it like at a comparison, almost like, if you know like Eldritch horror type of lore, like a lot of Eldritch horror, like the Eldritch gods, like, you only at any point in time like see a small glimmer of them because they're just so big and so incomprehensible to like our kind of, you know, our mental state and our understanding. And it's so like with them, even when you're like, even in like that, those kind of stories and that kind of, those kind of films, like you're only ever seeing like a little piece of it because it's just so incomprehensible to the rest of us. And that's part of the horror of that.
Yeah.
And this kind of presenting it in this kind of way, like, we get that glimpse into the real horror that's going on.
Yeah, and in this sense, like, we as the audience are in the same position as Jake, because he sees this and he's like, why? Like, you have all this money. Why do you need to do this? Cross is like, he asks, what are you going to buy after this? Like, what are you trying to do? And he's like, I'm trying to buy the future.
Yeah.
It's such a human greed, and like, there's no limit to it. And you couldn't place this in a better scenario than building LA out of the desert and like using the water as a weapon to fulfill political stuff, just to do what?
Just like, to make more money, just to make more money on top of like all of the other money that you already have. Like, like, he literally just admits that, right? Like,
he doesn't even know how much money he has.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter. He wants more and he wants the future. He wants control. He wants everything.
It literally is just like one of the best, most well-written screenplays in that sense, because, and this is honestly, this is the other part of why I like this genre of movies so well, is because I find that the noir and neo-noir films explore these kind of human ideas without putting a pretty bow on them.
Yeah.
It just like, it says like, let's take like just a pure unmasked look at the depravity of humanity and and just reconcile with like these kind of darker corners of the human experience.
Yeah, and it's just always happening all around us, and most of us are just dealing with it, like living
Well,
our
and what can
lives
we do,
like,
right? Like, it's Chinatown, you
yeah,
know?
it's Chinatown.
Like, that's literally what the quote means. It's like,
Yeah.
what are you gonna do? You,
Yeah.
like, you're just a small fish in a big pond.
Yeah.
And at some point, you just have to accept it in a way. And, like, that's again, that's the whole point of the end of the movie is like, it's Chinatown. You just have to
Yeah.
accept it. Like, there are forces beyond our control. Like,
Yeah, which like that ending, man.
oh my God.
So fucking good.
Oh my God. It's one of the best endings of a movie. It's one of the best dark endings of movie ever, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, and the build up towards it, like the reveal of Mrs. Mulray being Cross's daughter, and then the eventual reveal of the girl that Mulray was being accused of having a side relationship with, her being like, "Well, she's my sister," and then she
Jake
and
was like,
her being
stop
like,
lying to me.
yeah, and she's like, you don't have a sister. Like, I found that in the records. Like, there's no record of your sister. Like, that would be something that would be obvious that he could
Yeah.
look into, right? And
Yeah.
that makes sense that he would look into that. And then so she's like, she's my daughter. And you're just confused. Like, you're just
Yeah.
confused like Jake, right? And he's just like slapping her around because he's angry and he's confused and he
Yeah.
doesn't understand what's going on.
And those slaps were real as
Yes, they
well,
were. Yeah,
which
because.
is a great movie history thing. She
Yeah,
asked
well.
him to hit her just to have it real. Yeah.
Faye Dunaway gets like a bad rap for being a difficult to work with actress, but on the flip side, like a lot of the stories I was reading about her and her career, like she is one of the most committed actresses of all time. Like she wants to get things right. And she, after they were doing that scene for multiple takes and it not feeling right, she was like, "You need to just slap me. Just like slap me as hard as you can. Let's get through the scene. Like we need this needs to be real because this is
Yeah.
such an important, crucial moment." In the primer, I said that there were scenes that like I like physically revolted from. And that was the first scene that I like physically like moved back in my chair to try to get away from this, like subconsciously, because like when she admits that like Cross had raped her, or like there's not even an implication, like the implication is probably that he raped her, but like he also is just this evil, evil man, and you don't even know like how old she was when this happened, like
15,
when.
she said, but
Okay, yeah, okay, I forgot about that part. So yeah, so he's like manipulating her, and she's like underage, and she's his daughter, like just it's layer upon layer of gross.
And like she couldn't even look at her daughter for so long because of the shame she felt and like all of the horror that she survived. And then
Yeah.
she, like, a huge part of this whole plot is that she comes back to like want to take care of her. Like that's kind of the motivation behind like how a bunch of the pieces started moving because Cross wants to,
Find the girl.
yeah. There's the water stuff and then there's the girl stuff.
Yeah.
And they just mesh and all hell breaks loose.
Well, that's what I wrote down like while watching this and doing my own detective work, right? It's like there was a point in time where I was like, okay, like there's this story at face value of a man who's potentially cheating on his wife, but this man is ingrained in the water system of
Yeah.
Hollywood, and there's all of this, like, you know, from the opening scenes, we see this thing happening where people are genuinely upset about water being diverted and all of this stuff going on. But then, you know, things start to, and I can't remember exactly, I wrote something down where I was like, it's starting to feel like, you know, like a typical movie in this genre that things are happening on top of things right now. There's something bigger to this story, and then it becomes like you said, there's that bit of human element, but then that again, it all comes back to the water, man.
Yeah. And again, like just going back to that slapping scene, that is like the door closing on the Hays codes as well, because he's like slapping her. I guess they were always slapping women, which is horrible, but that scene was so real and visceral because of the realness of the slaps and everything. But then
Right.
also it's revealed that there's incest, which was not something that was
Yeah, that's a good
ever
point.
allowed within the Hays Codes. Maybe like small implications here and there or something like that, but like it's all about bridging old and new Hollywood, like I said in the primer. Yeah, you bring in the Hays Codes as being broken down, and this is like early in what films were now capable of, just adds to the depth of like how far they're able to take it.
It honestly, it's like this buildup over decades, right, of like people not being able to tell the stories that they want to tell. And then in the 70s, like, it's just all of that kind of just boiled over as soon as the Hays Code went away. And we got like everybody just spewed out every thought that they had about humanity.
Yeah.
And that's like part of the reason why, or one of the reasons why, all of this storytelling in the 70s is so great. I love the 70s for movies. And like, I've heard like over years that like Quentin Tarantino is such a big fan. And like over the course of this podcast, I've just become so in love with 70s Hollywood.
Yeah, I want to watch more. Like, I feel like I'm learning so much about that era, and it really is the second golden age.
Yeah, just like we're living in the golden age of television now, back in the 70s, you were in the golden age of Hollywood.
Do you think the golden age of television is over yet?
No. I think we're still going pretty strong, honestly. Like, watch the new Fallout show recently, and starting that, and it's freaking great. And I just... The thing is there's almost too much content now, and it's hard to like find the good stuff, and then you have to see the good stuff before the good stuff gets canceled, because if you don't see it, then it might get canceled, and then you don't get to see more of the good stuff.
Yeah, but you could always watch it later, but then there's 10 more shows to watch, so.
Yeah, exactly. So, oh, there's one scene that I wanted to mention that we've kind of skipped past, but it's honestly, it feels like not that big of a scene, but just the cinematography and the decisions of that scene are just like... just something that's going to live inside my head for forever. And it's a scene where Jake heads back to Mulray's office the second time, his government works office. And, you know, he wants to ask his successor. He wants to look around a little bit more. He's going to ask his successor a few questions. And it's just like one of the best scenes of a film that I've ever seen, just because of like how it's written.
Yeah.
You know, he shows up, that he's sitting there, the man doesn't want to see him, he's kind of talking to the receptionist, and he kind of just like starts to actually look around the room and identify things around the room. Like, we see Mulray and Cross and many of the pictures together. And it's just like one of those classic like themes of the receptionist knows everything. And so he's kind of just like starting to pick her brain a little bit while they're there. And she kind of recognizes, like, she almost kind of realizes that he's starting to do that, because then she goes to talk to the other guy to get him out of there, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The other part of why I like this scene so much is because everybody is trying to erase Mulray in this scene. The receptionist is like, doesn't want to talk about him. They're literally like chipping his name off of the door.
Yeah.
And then when we go back into the room, like Mulray's old office, all of the pictures have been taken down, but all of the like dust that has settled around the picture frames is still there. I don't know if you noticed that, but it's just like, as soon as I saw that, I was like, that is such smart filmmaking right there. Like, I love that everybody is trying to erase him, but the shadow of him is just like so wide over everything right now. Like, so impressed.
Like, the details are awesome in this.
Yeah, and that's, I think, like, for me, going back and rewatching this at some point, I think that's what I'm going to appreciate more, is catching all of those little details, because that's something that, like, obviously that plays into the story and there's like this subconscious stuff that that's trying to tell in that scene. But it's also, and maybe this is the point in time where I can ask you, like, you know, this is your second time watching, like, how, what was your viewing experience knowing where the plot was heading and knowing all of the big plot beats?
It was almost the exact same as the first viewing, because there was a year or two in between where I was like, I was remembering, like, I remembered the majority of all the plot points and stuff, but I was just enjoying the ride because I knew the payoff was gonna be so massive. I just allowed myself to fall into it again because I knew that's how the movie is. Of course, I was still like tracking things and remembering, like, oh yeah, I remember last time I wrote down like what's up with the boy on the horse, and then it comes back and he tells him about the water is being released at certain times. And I was like, is there going to be more with that? I don't know. It reminded me of all the questions that I had. And so I was thinking about them as I was watching it, but then I just get lost. I get sucked back in and stop thinking about things. And then I'm like, oh, wait, what about this? And I was like, do I remember that? And then it was a very fun rewatch.
So this has rewatchability.
100%.
I was hoping that you would say that, but... And I think this is a movie, again, I brought up the movie Seven and I brought up the movie Silence of the Lambs in the Primer episode, but with movies like this that are really dark, and especially the endings with how bleak and dark they are, like, they're movies that I don't like to come back to on an annual basis or something like that. But like every few years, like I kind of cycle through them, right? Like I haven't seen Seven in probably 4 or 5 years at this point. I'm kind of due for it again. Mm. And I'll watch it again and just be like just as engrossed, just as grossed out.
Yeah.
And I'll have just an absolute hate pleasure watching it. Not even hate pleasure. I don't even know the right words to describe it. Just like it's such a goddamn good movie. And like I'll just feel disgusted and feel so satisfied at the end. And I'll just take a break for 5 years and get to watch it again, you know? Like,
yeah. Yeah. Like the ending is such a good payoff, especially because it's not a typical ending and it leaves you like with like your guts on the floor kind of thing. It's like, and it's Chinatown.
Yeah. We can talk a little bit because we've kind of been talking a little bit around the end scene. Like I do really want to capture all of that. Like, just breaking down that end scene, like, you know, at this point, even like Jake, it's so interesting seeing Jake develop over this film, right? Because Jake starts off and he's almost got like a nostalgia for his time in Chinatown, right?
Yeah.
But because of his time in Chinatown, he's left to become a private investigator because he understands or he understood that his time in the police force in Chinatown and not being able to actually do good and improve the streets and fix the underlying problems, it wore him down. And so he moved into this area where he could actually make a difference and make a change for the better.
At the same time, he was also, every time somebody came in, it seemed like to me, at the beginning when the fake Mrs. Mulroney comes in, or whatever her name is, Mulray, he's like, maybe her husband is cheating. Why don't we just let sleeping dogs lie and just go home? Like who cares? Right. Like he's got that like chip on his shoulder still where he's
well,
like,
it's almost, sorry, I was going to say, it's almost like he having seen the dark pits of humanity almost doesn't want to let people in on that. Like he's almost trying to protect them. Right. In a sense.
Yeah, and at the same time, when I first watched it, I remember thinking, like, is this, like, a ploy? Like, how is he, like, is he saying that to get more money, kind of, get them more emotional about it, like, that kind of thing? Because he is smart.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, I think, again, there's layers to it.
But then, like, as he develops and as he this becomes more and more personal to him, and as everything kind of unfolds, like, in that ending scene where, you know, everything's playing out in Chinatown and he's been betrayed at this point. And even at this point in time, he's somehow reverted back where he's like, the police are going to fix this. Everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Don't run away right now with your daughter.
Put the gun down. Yeah.
Yeah. Like put the gun down. Like this is, let's just sort this out like civilized people would. And he's lost in the sauce at this point, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, like how he is when he's like, just give me 5 minutes, please. I'll explain everything. Like this guy, like Cross is rich and he's got power and like he's freaking out trying to get his old partner to see, like to just listen. But then, what is her name?
Mulray?
Yeah, Mulray.
Evelyn?
Evelyn, yeah. She's like, he owns the police.
Yeah, and she's just like trying to remind us, because even at that point in time, like I feel like as the audience, again, because we're all seeing this through his eyes, it's like even as the audience, we do want to believe. We want to believe in the powers that be. We want to believe that the police are there to protect us, but that's not always the case, right?
Mm-hmm,
like, oh my God, Cross is so disgusting. Like I was like physically squirming this whole scene, like while he's like trying to talk to his daughter, granddaughter, and like, and Evelyn's pushing him back at everything. And like, you know, he's using that like parental kind of like lighter voice. And it's just, it's so disturbing on such like a primal level, right?
Yeah.
And it's all for greed. Like he doesn't even care. Like this is just this is more greed. This is greed on top of greed for him.
Yeah. He wants everything and he wants it his way and he will get it. And he does. That's what is crazy about it, because like the police shoot out the car as she's driving away.
Yeah.
And you think it's still going in the distance. And then it kind of slows down and stops.
And the horn's going, right? You know she's shot as soon as you hear the horn.
Yeah, but that you're still not sure. And then the screaming from
the daughter. So did you while watching this the second time, when she hit her head on the horn while they're having their discussion in the car, did that, like, you know, ring any bells? Like, oh my god, that's wild foreshadowing with you?
No,
all?
It didn't, actually.
Because it was just something I was thinking about.
I might have missed it on this rewatch just because I was going through it quicker.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. It's when they're at her house and she's hiding the girl and getting mad at her and she's trying to explain it but not explaining it and still lying to him, and she's just like exasperated and she like puts her head on the horn for a minute and just like lets it blare.
Oh, I wish I was like fully zoned in at that point. I might have been like writing something down or something, but
yeah
that's awesome, because again, the writing, like, there's so many of these little throwaway lines and little actions that are just, they
payoffs.
All mean something.
Yeah, and I think that's part of why this movie is going to work so well on a rewatch for me, is because identifying stuff like that, and like, now that we have all of the details of where the crime is going to eventually lead, we get to now see this from a different angle, and that's like putting all of the facts together to indict this man, or whatever the term is. And so breaking down like that final scene more, like her dying is such a visceral point, and then like Cross comes in and just like grabs her head and just like pulls her away, and again, that's like that eldritch horror of like, I was literally like in my seat, like screaming, like, oh, like I felt so disgusted, because he literally just like grabs her face and like pulls her away from the action,
because
because
you know he's a shitty person. He doesn't like grab her gently. He's like trying to pretend that he wants to do is take her away from the horror that she's witnessing and protect her, but that's not his intentions. Like his intentions are like, finally I have her, I'm not gonna let her go.
I win.
Yeah, I win.
And you see that play out in his character and his performance. That's why, like I said, this is one of the best performances on film ever. Is like, you see him like lean over to check if she's dead, and you can see it on his face. He's checking to see if she's dead, to see if he's won or not yet.
Yeah.
And then he starts to console her, and it's just like, all of it's so disgusting, man, because he's playing it so well, and it's like so disgusting and like, it's...
You add in again, like, you see her eye just blown out, like the gore of it, that like the only
and this
other...
is 10 years after like JFK's been murdered in his car, right? And so like that in the 70s would have just absolutely like devastated people going to see this movie, right?
Yeah, I can't imagine watching this for the first time in theaters back then. Like,
oh my
people,
god,
I want to read more about it. Like, what was it like, the people walking out of those theaters?
And yeah, it's shown in pretty gross detail, right? Like, it, I wasn't expecting them to show as much as they did at that point in time.
Yeah.
And the final touch on all of this, actually one of the final touches, because you could talk about, honestly, I think you could talk about this one scene, this 5-minute scene, for like hours, because there's just so much detail in it. But one of the other details that I really appreciated was how the camera style changes slightly when they get to the car. And so after he's taken her away and it kind of pans over, the camera suddenly feels like it's almost like a news reporter or the paparazzi shoving the camera in their face, right? Like,
it's the way
that it's presented. Yeah, it's a little too close. It's like presented and it's kind of just like turning between the characters slowly, trying to get their reactions to what's going on, right? Like, and the lighting is different in this moment too. Like, the lighting throughout the film is very naturalistic, but in this moment in particular, like, it literally feels like it's 3 a.m. in the middle of Chinatown, and the only lighting is coming from this camera that's being thrown in their face at this point, trying to catch their reaction to all of this.
Yeah. I couldn't hear it. What does Jake say under his breath?
That was the thing that I couldn't hear either the first time, and so I did look it up. His final line is, as little as possible. Because I thought he said, you're responsible. And so I was like, yeah, okay, I get it. But then I looked it up and he says, as little as possible, which is, that's a callback to him and the lieutenant's time together in Chinatown, because that's what the lieutenant referred to their time, what they were doing in Chinatown, was as little as possible, right?
Yeah.
So that's like an accusation that he's throwing at the lieutenant that, you know, like, you, everything that you've done up until this point, like, that's his accusation, is you just did as little as possible, and this is your fault. this is on your hands. I tried so goddamn hard for this not to be the result of this.
Yeah.
And then, you know, again, we get like just the absolute, like one of the greatest ending lines in movie history is "Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown."
Yeah. And you can only understand it if you watch the whole movie and like you see the buildup of that backstory intertwined with what's happening at such a higher level.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Like the payoff of this movie is just one of the greatest like endings of a film ever. It's in the most deplorable way.
Yeah, because really, like again, with the how straight up the whole, like it's a slow build, but it's constant, and then it builds up and just drops you off a cliff.
Yeah.
There's no like climax and then a little bit after and you see something else. It's like there's no ups and downs. There's no resolution. It's just like this is the final resolution, and it's basically everything is back to how it started before this movie started with his time in Chinatown. And it's all just wrapped up so sick, like secularly.
Yeah, that's such a great point, right? Like, yeah, it goes back to like us just telling the same stories over and over again, and like I don't know, like it's just it's so good. It just speaks so much to like so much of the human experience, right? Like
even happening behind the camera with goddamn Roman Polanski.
Yeah, which is just like wild.
Yeah, so he made this movie about a girl getting raped at 15 and that nothing is ever going to change while he was probably doing that.
It's gross. It's like it's so strange, right? And like it's something that I've seen before in like talking about some of these genre filmmakers, is that like some of these genre filmmakers are exploring their own like their own darkness and their own dark part of their hearts and their minds, and like it's so true in like in a gross sort of way that how intertwined Polanski is with Chinatown.
Yeah, like it's mind-boggling just everything that it means, and it's all happening in this, and then it's just consistently happening across human history and like film history. It's too much sometimes. Like the way you feel at the end of the movie is how you feel when you think about all of the other things that are continuously happening. I don't know.
This is one of the most bitter and cynical films that I've ever seen.
I could see a lot of people walking out of that theater being disgusted by it, and then like I wonder if they got it. I think they did, because it was like around like the Vietnam and like Nixon, all like so many things were happening there, so like I think it was so timely but also just like too real.
Yeah, and that's where I think that in 2024 I feel like this movie is in really a good position to just absolutely shine again 50 years later. Like this is the 50 year anniversary is in a couple of months from now of when this was released back in June of 1974. And just like, it's so funny how just history rhymes, right? Like I've said this before on this podcast, even like it just feels like we're repeating the vibe of the 70s and right now, right? Like with the inflation and oil and like all of the problems with humanity, right? Like every 50 years we just cycle through a new cycle, and like each generation just kind of was like three generations back that generation kind of thing, just dealing with those problems.
We're all Jakes.
We're
all Jakes, you know, in Chinatown.
Other than the people who are the crosses in
you're either a Jake or you're a cross, or you're one of like the lieutenant or the secretary.
Your analogy is falling apart.
It'll come back around soon.
I want to shout out just like two other scenes before we wrap up. Like I just scenes that I absolutely love and I wanted to appreciate before we never talk about this movie again. The Orange Grove scene is like, I thought at that time I was like, this is the best cinematography of the whole movie. Like this is such a great like piece of action in the scene. It's shot incredibly well. It's
the car crash lit.
Yeah, the car crash and everything. Just like even driving like through the orange groves and he's being shot at and everything. Just like absolutely loved that scene. And right up until the end, I was like, that there's no scene that's going to beat that scene for me. And then like the ending, obviously, like I just spewed about for like 20 minutes there.
Yeah.
Oh, and like even just like subverting my expectations as well. Like when Evelyn says to Jake, like, my father is a very dangerous man, I was like, ooh, I was like, that right there is my tip off as somebody who watches these kinds of movies to, like, start to think that she's maybe not the good guy here. Like, oh, like, she might be a black widow in this, in this story, right? Because that's, like, a common theme of, like, the old noir films, like, the black widow character. And so I was starting in the back of my mind, like, to get a little bit, like, oh, like, we can't trust her now kind of thing. And, like, that's kind of my preconception of this genre, knowing that, right?
Just, like, Faye Dunaway's, like, performance up to that point, just, like, as soon as that happens, you're like, oh, like, she's been acting in that way this whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, she, you can tell that she's not giving away everything when she's talking, but, like, you also, because we don't even know the questions to ask her, like, how would you ever pick apart what she's saying, right? You know, like, that's part of the dilemma of being a detective is, like, if you're not asking the right questions, you're not going to get the right answers. Even if they lie to you, at least maybe you've detected something in the way that they've told you something. But if, again, if you're not asking the right questions, you're not going to get the right answers.
Yeah. And he was always just like, every question, like, he used questions well as, like, a detective and was just constantly curious about what was going on. And so, like, that, I don't know if that fits into what you just said. I might have lost the plot a bit. I was reading my notes. Shit, sorry.
No worries. The other scene that I wanted to shout out was the scene where Jake shows up at the fake Mulray girl's house and she's been murdered. And it, as it turns out, that the police have already shown up at her place and have found her body there. And they're kind of waiting to see how he reacts. And they're in the darkness of the bathroom the whole time.
Yeah.
Very, like, well shot, choreographed, like, one of those scenes that's going to stick with me forever because of, like, them just being in the washroom and, like, and he kind of, like, at the last second recognizes that there's somebody there, right? Mm-hmm. And then they, like, turn on the lights and they're like, yeah, we were watching you this whole time. And, like, we caught that your phone number's on, written on her wall beside her phone kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was just good filmmaking.
Again. Yeah. And, again, like, one of the funny lines that he just throws at one of the cops there about, like, the cop is like, oh, how'd you get, like, what happened to your nose? Did it get stuck in someone's window? Because he's known to be photographing or photographing adulterers. And he's like, no, it was your wife's legs. She opened them too quick or something like that and hit me in the nose. And, like,
it's one of the funniest lines of the whole movie, right?
Yeah. And he has so many of those. And, like, that adds so much enjoyability to the whole thing.
He's kind of playing, like, almost like a Bill Murray and Chevy Chase character, but, like, straighter than them, like, less slightly less of an asshole and slightly less comedic kind of thing. Like, I could see those two comedians pulling something from this performance, even just bigger picture Jack Nicholson as a whole, right? Which is really cool.
I didn't know Jack Nicholson would have been as funny back then. Like, I thought, like, maybe in his old age he switched to comedy because it's a little easier or something like that in some of his roles. But, like, he was always like that, and he just nailed it, like, his delivery. And he has that such a unique delivery, except except for Leo, because he stole that from him. But I'm obsessed with the fact that they are so similar.
Yeah.
And you, like, I would never have connected that unless I watched this.
Yeah, and similar, slightly similar career paths, too. And, like, again, The Departed's a little bit the passing of the torch, so.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a Scorsese movie, which after that, it's just like Scorsese and Leo just doing it together for like five movies in a row.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're doing it live. The last kind of thing that I want to point out before we move on from in front of the camera is the saltwater bath for the grass.
Yes. Yeah.
It's so funny because, you know, he says that so early on in the film and you just don't have any context for it, right?
Yeah.
And it means nothing when he's saying that early. Like, I didn't even understand what he was saying at that point in time. Like, well, he's just like cleaning that and like, yeah, okay, maybe I should have gotten that, like, yeah, they've maybe got like some salt water.
He didn't say salt water the first time.
I don't know what he said. Like, that's the thing that I'm going to have to go back and rewatch. Because I thought he did say salt water is bad for the grass.
No, the first time he just says the water's bad for the grass or something. And he didn't catch it because he's like, bad for the glass. And then the second time he goes back, he's like, bad for the glass, right? And then the guy repeats, but he says, yeah, the salt water is bad for the grass. And he's like, salt water?
Yeah, because at that moment in time, we know that Mol Ray has been drowned in salt water, but then dumped in the reservoir,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is
fresh water.
Like fresh water. And again, like that's that moment, just like while you're watching this movie and like trying to get in the detective headspace, you're just like, oh my God, that's where he was drowned, is in the pond
yeah,
the whole
yeah.
time. And then we get the glasses.
Yeah, and the glasses and the grass and the glass.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. And then the glasses are like a little bit of a red herring because we think they're her glass. No, we think they're Mulray's glasses.
Yes.
And we've never seen Mulray close enough up, or we haven't seen him in so long, right? Like,
yeah.
Who would have thought to look at what glasses he was wearing in the opening part of the film, right?
Yeah.
It's not even like the style of the glasses. It's the bifocal nature of the glasses.
She only mentions that after going
He's
through
accused
the
whole... her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At that point, we still aren't sure. Like, it just adds another layer to the whole mix, and you're just confused again for, like, a little bit, and then he reveals it.
Right.
And yeah.
I think part of why this succeeds is because, again, we're seeing all of this through Jake's eyes, and so as an audience, we never feel tipped off to anything, right?
Yes.
And so... there are times in a movie that just, it feels like the answer is so obvious because maybe it's even been revealed to us that we're almost annoyed with the main character for not noticing the obvious here.
Yeah.
And this movie does a good enough job of like just leaving that outside of what we can see in this movie, right?
Yeah.
Like nothing's ever very obvious as to what's really going on.
And like as a person who... like, I have called so many little things like that in movies. Like, when I'm watching with Annabelle, she gets annoyed. And then I'm like, I was right, though. And then, like, I couldn't do that in this movie.
No.
Because of the way it was shot and written.
Yeah. And that's something about, like, again, going back to, like, older Hollywood and not hand-holding the audience, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just, you just really come to appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. I really liked how he grabbed a card off of the other guy's desk. When he went in to the water department, he grabbed like multiple cards from the guy's desk.
Oh, from Mulray? Yeah, to use them later?
It wasn't Mulray, it was the other guy.
Oh, yeah. No, you're right.
So like I wrote down like always grab a card. Because you might be able to use that and pretend to be that person. So I bet he has like a stack of cards with just random like persons' names that he thought like, oh, this person works in this area. I'm going to grab a card and pretend to be them for my PI work later. Like
that's such a second watch like detail that like I
oh, yeah.
caught it and didn't think about the prominence of that and like how smart of an idea that was to grab multiples of them and then use them later like that.
Yeah, and he's just always thinking that kind like he's been in this space, he's done this work, and he has rules for like how to be the best that he can. And so he's always looking for those little opportunities to like yeah, he grabbed like six cards and like fanned it back out so it looked like only one was taken.
Yeah.
That was just like one of those nice little scenes that I loved on the second rewatch.
Yeah, that's great. I'm genuinely looking forward to rewatching this at some point, but I'm going to need a break from it. Maybe a few showers.
Yeah.
So sequels, prequels, and reboots. This movie does actually have a sequel called The Two Jakes, which both stars and is directed by Jack Nicholson. It went through development hell. Like it literally took 16 years to make this movie. It didn't come out until 1990. Not well received by any means. I think that someday I might actually end up watching it to see, like, just out of curiosity more than anything, and just becoming a bigger fan of Jack Nicholson. Like, I feel like it's, you know, a milestone in his career that I want to check out. But otherwise, like, I wouldn't consider it like required viewing by any means.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm just looking at the poster for the Two Jakes, and it to me it looks like he saw everything that was going on and he's like, well, if you can't beat him, join him. So I'm curious how. Yeah, I kind of want to see it. I know, yeah, six 63% on Rotten Tomatoes. Like, yeah, not the best reviews or whatnot. But
well, and Robert Towne, like, eventually at one point was writing the script for it, and he had in mind like a trilogy about like the corruption in Hollywood and the making of LA, and like, so the three kind of, it was going to be all like almost like similar-ish stories. Like, this one was about water, the other one was going to be about oil, and the last one was going to be about land. And I just feel like that would have kind of felt pretty played out by the second movie, honestly.
Yeah, if they did it in the right time, like, it sounds like a good concept for that period, but now it might not work.
I don't know, like, honestly, it's kind of like The Hangover, right? Like, the first Hangover just does something unique and incredible, and at the time it was like, this is so groundbreaking and such a great idea, and then they tried to copy it twice more.
Yeah.
That's and it made the first Hangover movie worse in retrospect because of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, effects and filming. So Roman Polanski and his kind of involvement in this, and just the like early stages of this, like, Robert Towne had the original script for this and everything, but Polanski did have a lot of involvement in a lot of the creative decisions. Like, for example, he shot this entirely from Jake's perspective to kind of stay true to like the original, like, OG detective stories.
Yeah, like, he got rid of the old school style of like him narrating himself.
Yeah, the voiceover completely removed. Like, I think that's a really great decision. There's points in time where it's literally shot like his back facing towards the action, like we're him seeing the action through his eyes, right? And there's never a scene where other characters are talking and we're seeing it and Jake isn't involved in that. Like, every single scene has him in it.
Yeah.
And even like the ending, the writing of the ending of the film, that was a Polanski decision. Like, the ending was going to be that, I believe, that Cross goes to prison or something like that, but he gets out and then like he, like, nothing's ever resolved kind of in its own kind of way. But the death of Evelyn is just like so much darker and so much more, like, it's so much more bold, right? And it's like part of the reason why this film is so great is the end, the last 5 minutes of this film just play out like, and it feels like so real.
Yeah,
right? Like, it doesn't feel like a Hollywood ending.
Yeah, it stops you dead in your tracks, and then what, you're just supposed to leave the theater?
Yeah. Like, I would have literally just sat there for like 5 minutes, like, wow.
Decompressing, yeah.
Yeah.
So much better than what it could have been, yeah. Like, if they did anything other than this, it wouldn't be what it is.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, it's just like one of those iconic filmmaking decisions. And then at the beginning, when he's talking to Polly about his wife, and it's actually like, so the character's name is Curly, but Polly from the Rocky movie series. In the original scene, he was supposed to tell Gittes that he's going to kill his wife afterwards, and Gittes was supposed to tell him that he's not rich enough to get away with murder, and that was going to be like in the opening scene being one of the like big foreshadowing what's going to happen later.
Yeah.
And Robert Towne said that that's his biggest regret of the changes in the movies. Like, he really wished that they had kept that.
Yeah, like, especially because of how jokey Jake was at the beginning. Like, that would have been just, like, a great little joke. Like, one of his classic lines that he would have been doing at the beginning like that.
It would have been, like, it's a pure on second or even maybe third rewatch where you catch that and you're like, God damn, they had me from the opening scene.
Yeah.
Right? Otherwise, like, some of the reality of where they took this from, like, we've talked a little bit about the California water wars and that being a real thing, and like the diversion of the, I think it's the Owens River and the Owens Valley, and all of their water and how that affected the farmers back then. And it literally drove like farmers who had lived there in California for generations out of their homes because of the massive droughts that they were causing and like man-made droughts.
All they wanted to do was develop that area and create their own, like, they created
without it LA would not have been able to grow anymore. They had reached the maximum capacity of people that they could have in Los Angeles, and now Los Angeles is like one of the biggest cities in the world, and that's because they diverted so many reservoirs of water down to the city.
And that allowed them to create the valley, which is like where all of the rich people, at least at one point, lived. I don't know what the layout of the city exactly is, but like,
yeah,
they bought all the land that would become prime real estate and then diverted the water so that it set them up just so goddamn well.
Yeah, it's like a tale as old as time, right? Like, you get the people to sell their stuff to you at like a cheap price, like you artificially destroy the price of something and then you buy it all up for cheap and then you sell it back to them for a premium. Other the real stuff, like there's an off sentence mention about a dam breaking and how like Mulray doesn't want that to happen again. Like, that's based in real history. It's actually like the biggest like human disaster in Californian history. It was like over 400 people died because a dam broke in like the early 1900s and just like swept people out to the ocean, essentially. Like, it was massive. Like, I was looking at pictures of it online and it's like crazy how much it like destroyed like so many lives at that point.
Yeah.
And that's like even goes back to, so the character of Mulray is based on Mulholland Drive, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And so Mulholland is like such an infamous person in LA history because without him, they would never have been able to build Hollywood to the size that it is. But at the same time, like, he also was extremely corrupt. Like, you know, he diverted all this water from people. He was the reason, like, he wasn't the reason for the dam breaking, but the day that the dam collapsed, he was actually requested to go there in the morning because the people who were working there were concerned about like the dam. And he went there and said everything's fine, and like within 12 hours the whole thing collapsed. And so that was actually like the whole reason why he ended up like completely getting like fired and let go from all of this, because of that kind of thing. So the whole history of Los Angeles, like, having absolutely like no interest in it before this movie, it was fascinating to read about all of this.
Yeah, like that opened up a whole area of like such a local history that has been so big for, like, it has a big impact on a lot of things.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely crazy. And like, again, the whole history is cyclical aspect of this. Like, recently there's been Katrina. That was a dam that shouldn't have, like, they knew it couldn't hold for a certain amount of storms or whatever. And that also like destroyed a whole area of Florida. So like, if they watched this movie, maybe they would have been fine.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And then, recently in like 2024, there was, somebody tried to build a very similar, like, the dam that they built was, it was basically just a bunch of sand. It shouldn't have worked. That was just corruption. Probably, the lowest bidder put in whatever. So it's still always happening.
Yep, 100%, right? It's, again, it's like one of those like timeless human stories of like min-maxing everything and how that eventually comes to bite us in the ass.
Yeah.
So the last kind of piece of kind of history that I want to mention is how Jack Nicholson's character and some of his quotes are kind of based on real life vice cops. So there was one guy in particular that actually had worked in LA's Chinatown, which pre like 1937, when this takes place, like Hollywood Chinatown or LA Chinatown is actually like a very important part of Los Angeles at that point in time. Like, it was actually like a dark, seedy place. And so they were interviewing a guy who was a cop in that era. And he said that the police were better off in Chinatown doing nothing because you could never tell what went on there. And basically, like, never knew if what you were doing was actually helping or actually hindering, like, the victims of the situation, right? And that's, like, that's something that I think the Western genre does really good. And that's something that, like, even in the Fallout show, like, very minor spoiler in, like, the first or second episode of the Fallout show, there's a point in time where a character has to make a decision of which two people to help, and you know immediately that they've chosen wrong, basically. And then something happens and the character kind of explains what had happened, and it's really funny. But it's also like, it's like that timeless thing, right, of like having to make like this kind of power of having to make these kind of decisions on the fly and whether or not that decision is going to be the right decision or not. And that weighs on you, right? Like, that's something that genuinely weighs on you.
Unless you're fully greed-filled and you don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Like, cross.
Yeah, exactly. Like, unless you're at the top, and but you and I just we're not anywhere near that. Like,
yeah,
we're significantly closer to Jake than we could ever be to Cross, and yeah. So we just are never going to understand that feeling of unlimited power.
Yeah,
and what that does to you.
Yeah, man, such a great movie.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. I want to shout out the movie poster because I think it's one of the all-time classic. Like movie posters, I think I could put that, hang that up. Like, it's been a long time since I said I could hang up a movie poster, but this is just one of my favorites of all time. Like, it's got Jake on it. It's kind of got that like smoky window image, and it's got Faye's eyes up at the top.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good. I literally am just absolutely in love with that movie poster. It's one of my favorites of all time. I'd never seen this movie before, and I had like fond memories of that movie poster.
Yeah, and it has like Chinese traditional art for the water at the bottom. Oh,
yeah.
I haven't looked at it with this kind of after the fact. Great poster. Yeah. I want
one of the best.
I'm gonna buy one.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. Ooh, okay. So part of the legacy of this movie is after this movie came out, I can't remember which magazine it was. Did some back history research into Jack Nicholson and found out that Jack Nicholson, who Jack Nicholson thought was his sister's entire life, was actually his mom.
Oh my God.
And that his grandparents had raised him his entire life. And so he literally didn't know about this until he was in his 30s after this movie came out.
That is absolutely insane.
Yeah, so he lived most of his life. He afterwards said, like, I was reading about all of this, he like said, he was like, you know, like, it was pretty dramatic, but he's like, you know, I'm an adult at this point. Like, it's not like it completely like
upended too much. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it didn't traumatize me. It was just like, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Because his mom had passed away at this point in time as well. Oh, so, like, it's not something he could confront her with or anything.
Yeah. That's crazy. We didn't go back to that scene where he's sitting down eating with Cross the fish. Jack Nicholson was dating John Huston's daughter, and so it was super awkward when they were filming that, them to be sitting there, and Noah Cross is like, are you sleeping with my daughter?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It was true.
and not only like, yeah, so there's so many layers to that as well, right? Because like, yeah, like you said, at that point, he's dating John Huston's daughter. She was actually on set. That was the one day that she was on set as well. It's such a pointed question that like it makes you as a viewer uncomfortable even because like this is a father asking just some random guy,
especially like how he asks, like just like it means nothing
out of the blue.
Yeah.
And it's just like, he doesn't care about it. And like,
so are you sleeping with her?
Like he asks it out of curiosity.
Then he backs it up like, oh, I have to protect her, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, yeah.
You don't even believe that though.
And it's like, there's all the layers to that character.
Yeah. I think this was nominated 11 times at the Oscars in 1975. Lost out a bunch of the Oscar roles to The Godfather Part 2, which is fair because The Godfather 2 is one of the greatest movies of all time.
Mm-hmm.
But it was nominated for Best Picture. Jack Nicholson was nominated. Faye Dunaway was nominated. Best Director. Best Writing for Robert Towne. And Best Original Screenplay. That's the one that actually did win, was Best Original Screenplay. So recognized there. Properly recognized. Best Cinematography nominated for. Nominations for Best Art Direction. Best Costume Design. Best Sound. Best Film Editing. And Best Music. So basically every single one of the main things that it could have been nominated for in that year, it was nominated for. It's one of those, again, one of those movies that just unfortunately was up against one of the movies of all time.
Yeah.
On that note, you know, this is considered number 161 on the IMDb top 250 list. And like for me, getting into personal reviews and The Partner Factor, like this is just an absolute, like one of the most flawless movies that I've ever watched. Like, yes, I will admit that the pacing is a little slow at points, but it's methodical. Like you said, it's got a very linear, like
trajectory,
line that it's heading. Yeah. And so I think that having gotten to the end, it makes it just more interesting to rewatch, knowing everything that I know now and getting to rewatch it again. I genuinely think like I'm going to have to see this a couple more times, but I wouldn't be shocked if this would end up on my top 100 list. Like, it's not going to be in my top 20, probably.
Yeah.
But it, like, it's objectively is one of the greatest movies of all time.
Yeah, definitely. I couldn't pick exactly where either, but, like, it would be so hard to put it too low. I would feel bad if I said like it's number 59 and there was other movies ahead of it. I'd be like, it deserves to be higher.
Yeah, there's just something about it, right? Like it's incredible, but it's also like just so disturbing and so raw that it's hard to say. It'd be like saying Silence of the Lambs is your favorite movie, or like The Fly is your favorite movie. There's just something off-putting about it that like it's hard to like classify really high while also recognizing that it's one of the greatest ever. Yeah, like I said, I absolutely love this movie, and I think it's worth just about everybody's time to at least see it once in their lives.
Yeah, and like Annabelle didn't watch this with me, but she was interested in it and she like heard certain scenes and then like I explained what was going on and she's like, I think I'd watch that.
Yeah, I just didn't really watch this one either with me, but she's kind of one of those people who's looking for movies as escapism, and this is just not that. It's not that at all.
This
It's
is too real.
yeah, oh, it's so raw. It's just all the praise for this movie.
Like I give a lot of movies a really good review because I love movies, but this deserves it objectively.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that is it for Chinatown.
Yeah. All right.
It was a great episode. That was fun.
That's Chinatown.
That's Chinatown, baby.
Yeah,
And the next episode is you and our first you and Mike special, Jason and Mike episode.
we're gonna have some fun out of the country.
Yeah, doing a foreign movie. Don't know
Yes.
what yet, but looking forward to hearing it. I think so. My strategy, because I haven't actually got to be on the other side of this yet. Whatever you guys pick, I'm gonna listen to the primer episode. I'm gonna watch the movie, and then I'm gonna listen to the deep dive episode.
Oh,
That's
good
my
idea.
strat. Yeah, I really want to do that. I haven't got to do that, had the opportunity to do that yet for the
Yeah,
podcast.
that's very
So.
fair. That makes sense. So, the way we're thinking is I've always wanted to explore foreign films. The easiest to watch, like the most accessible, are like Japanese
Samurai movies
samurai
because of
movies.
their Western influence or
Exactly.
the later
Like
F Western
they've
influence, yeah.
been so intertwined with just movie history. But we want to go outside of that. And so we are looking at a French film. And so I don't know if anyone has any suggestions, but we're going to be looking for like, what is the movie to watch if you're a movie fanatic and haven't yet stepped into French films? So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, no, it sounds like a lot of fun. Yeah, every time I see a Kurosawa movie pop up, I'm like, oh, we really need to do Kurosawa. Like, I really need to see a Kurosawa movie. I've never seen a Kurosawa movie before, so it's one that I'm getting to the point where I'm just gonna end up watching one without like outside of the podcast because I need to just scratch that itch.
I don't know if I actually know them. Who is Kurosawa?
Yeah, so we did the other popular Japanese director, but like Kurosawa is Seven Samurai and Rashomon and Ron.
Right, okay. I don't think I've seen Seven Samurai. I recognize, but I don't know any of the other ones that I'm seeing pop up. So,
Ron is
interesting.
apparently like one of the greatest movies ever made. It's supposed to be just mind-blowingly good. So I
When
there's
you sent me that, I was like, oh my God, I want to watch that right now. But
yeah.
then we have, it's
I
tough
think
to
I'm
fit
just
it
gonna
in.
pick one in the next year, and I'm just gonna watch it outside of the podcast because it's just like I said, it's an itch that I just need to scratch. Because who do we do? Because we did Harakiri, right? Oh, it was Kobayashi.
Kobayashi.
But anyway, we're off on a big tangent here.
Yes.
We should wrap this episode up. This is a great episode. It was a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to what you guys pick next for the French foreign film.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. And thanks for listening.
As
And
always, tell your father.
And now that I'm a father,
Well,
I'm
you're
gonna
not a
tell
father
myself.
yet.
I consider myself one.
Fatherhood begins at the moment of conception.
Yes, that's what I believe very strongly. All right.
All right, see you next time.